Chapter 2. Understanding Ecology and Biodiversity. The environment and the study of the environment encompass everything that surrounds us, including all living and non-living things. Ecology is the study of the relationships and interactions between living organisms and their surrounding environment. The term ecology derives from the Greek word for house or dwelling, oikos, and study, or logi. In other words, ecology is the study of our house, and it is at the core of what environmental science is about. The goal of this chapter is to give you a foundation in some key ecological concepts that will be important to studying environmental issues in subsequent chapters. The chapter starts by introducing the idea of the Earth as a system, and how ecologists and environmental scientists use a systems view, or systems thinking, in the work they do. We will then focus on the study of the environment at the ecosystem scale, considering what ecosystems are, how they are defined, and what some of their key characteristics are. We will review two fundamental ecosystem processes, energy flow and matter cycling, that play a central role in understanding environmental issues. We then shift to the concept of biodiversity, what it means, why it matters, and what are the major threats to it. The chapter concludes with a brief discussion of an interesting concept known as planetary boundaries. These boundaries were developed as a way to help us think of the planet's overall health and to warn us when our actions might be jeopardizing the environment we all depend on. If we think of ecology as the study of our house, planetary boundaries are a way for us to monitor and stay aware of threats or dangers to the planet we all call home. Section 2.1. The Earth as a System. Throughout this book, and in the study of environmental science, you will frequently hear the environment described as a system, or as being composed of numerous interconnected systems. What does this mean, and why does it help to think about the environment in terms of systems? A system can be defined as a set of connected or interdependent things that together form a more complex whole. For example, the car you drive is made up of multiple interacting systems that work together to provide you with mobility. These include the ignition, electrical, braking, steering, cooling, and suspension systems. Likewise, a rainforest in Borneo, a wetland along the Gulf Coast, a mountain stream in the Rockies, or a grassland in the upper Midwest can all be thought of as systems, in this case, ecosystems. Forests, wetlands, streams, grasslands, and other ecosystems all consist of organisms and elements that are interdependent and that together make up a more complex whole. Given the sheer complexity of the Earth as a system, ecologists and environmental scientists find it helpful to view and study the world at different scales. They do this through an approach known as the ecological hierarchy theory. The ecological hierarchy illustrates the relationships between different organisms and organizes those relationships into different levels. At the first level of the ecological hierarchy are individual organisms, such as a single elephant or bird. Multiple individuals of the same species living in a particular location, such as a herd of elephants or a flock of birds, are considered a population. The second level of the ecological hierarchy. A group of populations of different species that interact and live in the same place, such as a forest, stream, or wetland, is known as a community, the third level of the ecological hierarchy. This community and its physical environment make up the next level, an ecosystem. In other words, ecosystems include the living or biotic communities that occupy them, as well as the non-living or abiotic, characteristics that often shape the abundance and diversity of life in that location. Different ecosystems connect and interact with one another. For example, a forest ecosystem connects with the stream ecosystem that runs through it, and make up a landscape. At an even larger scale or higher level, ecosystems and landscapes that have similar climate and vegetation can be grouped into biomes. See Figure 2.1 in your ebook. Generally speaking, tropical regions characterized by warm temperatures, an abundance of moisture, and relatively constant levels of daylight, contain the biomes with the highest number and diversity of organisms. Let's use an example to illustrate the ecological hierarchy at work. See figure 2.2 in your ebook. We'll start with a single bird common to our state of Pennsylvania, the wood thrush. A certain population of wood thrushes breeds and reproduces in a specific forested region near the home of one of the authors. That population of wood thrushes interacts with other populations of birds, mammals, insects, and plants at the community or biotic community scale. The biotic community, combined with the abiotic or non-living components, make up an ecosystem, in this case a forested ecosystem that the wood thrush favors as habitat. That forest is embedded in a larger landscape of rivers, streams, wetlands, and human-dominated land uses. The forests of Pennsylvania are similar to temperate forests in other regions of the United States and the world, and make up part of the temperate forest biome. At the highest scale, or level, the entire planet is made up of four separate but interacting realms, or spheres. See figure 2.3 in your ebook. These four spheres include the lithosphere, or geosphere, the hydrosphere, the atmosphere, and the biosphere. The lithosphere is the solid Earth, specifically the upper crust, extending up to 100 kilometers or 62 miles below the surface, and the uppermost mantle, extending as far as 2,500 kilometers or 1,550 miles below the surface. The hydrosphere is the watery parts of our planet, the oceans, rivers, lakes, clouds, groundwater reservoirs, and glaciers that cover three-quarters of the Earth's surface. The atmosphere is a mixture of gases, mostly nitrogen and oxygen, with smaller amounts of argon, carbon dioxide, and other trace gases. The atmosphere is held to the Earth's surface by gravity and thins rapidly with altitude. 99% of the Earth's atmosphere is concentrated in the first 30 kilometers, 19 miles. But a few traces of atmospheric gases remain even in frigid, near-space conditions, thousands of kilometers above the Earth's surface. The biosphere is the zone where life exists on Earth. Most life concentrates at or near the surface of the land and ocean. But some bacteria thrive in rocks 4 kilometers, 2.5 miles beneath the surface. Some organisms live in deep ocean trenches, and a few wind-blown microorganisms drift in thin, cold, inhospitable airwaves 10 kilometers, 6 miles above the surface. Most of this book will focus on issues and conditions that occur in the biosphere, but we will also examine the lithosphere, energy resources, the hydrosphere, freshwater and ocean resources, and the atmosphere, climate change, air pollution, and ozone depletion. The concepts of the ecological hierarchy and the four spheres allow us to take something as vast and complex as the entire planet and view it at many different scales. A systems view, or systems thinking, helps us see how the pieces within each level connect and interact. Systems thinking is an approach to science that considers not just the individual parts of a system, but also how they interact and interrelate over time. When we think of the environment as a system, we become more aware of how our actions in one place might have consequences in another. The late ecologist Barry Commoner summed this up in his first law of ecology: everything is connected to everything else. Credit 1971. Section 2.2 will home in on one level of the ecological hierarchy, the ecosystem. Much of the work done by ecologists and environmental scientists is at the ecosystem scale, and so it is important to better define and understand what ecosystems are and how they operate. Section 2.2, Ecosystems as a Concept. Section 2.1 described ecosystems as a collection of living, or biotic, and non-living, or abiotic, entities that exist and interact in a particular location and time. For example, the forest ecosystem that is home to the wood thrush is made up of birds, insects, mammals, amphibians, fungi, trees and plants, soils, rocks, and nutrients. Forests and other ecosystems are characterized by a number of factors that are the focus of this section. Ecosystems are open. Virtually all of the Earth's ecosystems are open systems, meaning that they receive inputs from surrounding systems and produce outputs. Some of ecosystems' most important inputs and outputs come in the form of energy and matter, which will be described in much greater detail in Section 2.3. For now, it's enough to visualize an ecosystem in much the same way you might view your home, as an open system that relies on inputs of food, energy, and water while producing outputs like solid waste, wastewater, and emissions of air pollutants. Ecologists refer to the energy and matter that flow into, through, and out of an ecosystem as throughput. Ecosystems are subject to feedback loops. As energy and matter flow into and out of ecosystems, and as ecosystems are subject to various kinds of disturbance and change, we often see what are known as feedback loops. A positive feedback loop causes the system to keep changing further in the same direction. A negative feedback loop causes the system to change in the opposite direction. In nature, a positive feedback loop might occur when a section of a forest is clear-cut, creating light and temperature conditions along the new forest edge that lead to even further loss of trees and worsening deforestation. A negative feedback loop might occur if there were a sudden increase in the population of a certain insect species. This might lead to an equivalent increase in the population of birds and other organisms that prey on or eat that insect, returning the insect population to what it was originally. Positive feedback loops tend to be destabilizing, resulting in continual change, while negative feedback loops tend to be self-correcting or stabilizing. In other words, don't think of positive feedback loops as good or negative feedback loops as bad. In fact, the opposite is generally the case. Most systems in nature are characterized by negative feedback loops, which result in a dynamic equilibrium or homeostasis, the tendency of a system to maintain relatively stable conditions over time. When a system is experiencing a series of positive feedback loops, changing further and further in the same direction, it's possible that it could reach a threshold or tipping point. When this happens, the system collapses or shifts to a new, different state. For example, when water is boiled to a tipping point of 100 degrees Celsius or 212 degrees Fahrenheit, it turns to vapor. When water is cooled to 0 degrees Celsius or 32 degrees Fahrenheit, it turns to ice. A potential tipping point that worries many environmental and climate scientists involves a positive feedback loop from melting permafrost areas in the Arctic. This will be explained in more detail in Chapter 8. But basically, permafrost soils hold large quantities of methane and carbon, which can become carbon dioxide as these soils thaw. Human activities like burning fossil fuels are already raising methane and carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. Methane and carbon dioxide are greenhouse gases that trap heat in the atmosphere, and this is increasing temperatures in the Arctic. As temperatures increase, permafrost soils begin to thaw and release more methane and carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. This methane and carbon dioxide leads to further warming and more thawing of permafrost soils, which results in even greater releases of methane and carbon dioxide, and so on. Such a situation could lead to rapid and runaway global warming and climate change, pushing our planet beyond a threshold and over a tipping point. Ecosystems provide a range of conditions. For a wood thrush to survive in the forested ecosystem in Pennsylvania, it requires certain resources and conditions, such as food, water, and reasonable temperatures. When these environmental factors and conditions are present in a way that is most favorable for the wood thrush, they are said to be in the optimal range. the entire range over which the wood thrush could survive, even if it did not thrive in an optimal sense, is known as the range of tolerance, with the extreme ends of that range known as the limits of tolerance. Conditions that fall between the optimal range and the limits of tolerance are known as zones of stress, because organisms experience increasing stress the further they are from their optimal range. All living organisms have an optimal range, zones of stress, and limits of tolerance for every abiotic factor they depend on. And these are different for different species. Some species have a very broad optimal range and can tolerate a wide variety of conditions, while other species are more sensitive and have optimal ranges that are narrow. Ecologists refer to a factor that limits growth as a limiting factor, meaning that even if other factors and conditions are present in optimal amounts, the absence or shortage of a limiting factor will stress organisms that depend on it. For example, you can give a plant all the water and nutrients you want, but if there is not enough light, the plant will be limited in its growth. Lastly, we generally find that certain species, like the wood thrush, are present in specific habitats, like a temperate forest. Within that forest, the wood thrush occupies a specific ecological niche, the combination of conditions and resources needed for it to live. Different species can occupy the same habitat, but have very different niches. Different bird species in the same forest habitat can nest in different places, eat different foods, eat at different times of the day, and have other differences in their ecological niche that limits competition between them. Section 2.3, Fundamental Ecosystem Processes, Energy Flow and Matter Cycling. Despite the range of conditions that characterize the ecosystems found in different biomes around the world, all these ecosystems have something in common. With few exceptions, Earth's ecosystems are powered by solar energy, and the organisms within those ecosystems depend on matter in the form of nutrients, water, oxygen, and other gases to survive. This section reviews two fundamental ecosystem processes that will help you better understand life on Earth: energy flow through ecosystems and matter cycling in ecosystems. Energy flow through ecosystems. The most basic definition of energy is the capacity or ability to do work. In ecology, the term energy is usually used to define the ability of organisms to do biological work, such as moving, growing, eating, or reproducing. Scientists further divide energy into two basic forms, kinetic and potential. Kinetic energy is energy in motion, while potential energy is stored energy. The image of a dam is often used to illustrate the difference between these two types of energy. By holding moving water back, a dam is creating a reservoir, which represents accumulated or potential energy. When the gates of the dam are open and the water starts to move again, that potential energy is converted to kinetic energy. Likewise, gasoline represents a type of potential energy, stored in the chemical bonds among the atoms that compose it. When that gasoline is ignited in the engine of a car, the potential energy held in those chemical bonds is released and converted to the kinetic energy of motion. Laws of thermodynamics. There are two fundamental laws or principles that apply to energy. The first law of thermodynamics, also known as the law of conservation of energy, states that energy can change from one form to another, but cannot be created or destroyed. When we burn gasoline in a car engine, we are converting that chemical energy to the energy of motion and heat, but we end up with the same amount of energy. The second law of thermodynamics states that even though the overall amount of energy is conserved, energy conversion will always change that energy from a more useful to a less useful state. Gasoline is a highly useful form of energy, because small quantities of it contain great potential to do work, but once combusted, it changes to mostly heat energy that is too diffuse to be useful. This tendency for energy to move from a more useful state to a less useful state is known as entropy. An important implication of the laws of thermodynamics is that energy conversions tend to be inefficient. Only a small portion of the chemical energy stored in gasoline, typically 15 to 25%, is actually converted to mechanical energy. If every energy conversion moves us from a more useful state to a less useful state, we would appear to be doomed to a world of increasing disorder. Yet, in the world around us, we see many signs of increasing order. For example, humans, animals, plants, and other organisms being born and growing. So, how can this be? The answer lies in the fact that the Earth is an open system, subject to inputs of solar energy. That incoming solar, or light energy, drives processes that create new stores of potential energy that fuel virtually all the Earth's ecosystems. Fuel for life. Most living systems and organisms on the planet are ultimately powered by energy from the sun. The starting point is a group of organisms known as autotrophs, or primary producers, mostly plants, algae, and some types of bacteria. Primary producers take the building blocks of carbon dioxide and water and produce sugar or glucose molecules with high potential energy content. Primary producers do this through a process known as photosynthesis. Photosynthesis is driven by light energy from the sun, as illustrated in Figure 2.4 in your ebook. The ability of plants and other primary producers to do photosynthesis is really the foundation for life on Earth as we know it. Photosynthesis starts with chlorophyll, which gives plants their green color. Chlorophyll absorbs light energy from the sun and uses it to remove hydrogen atoms from water, or H2O, molecules. The hydrogen is combined with carbon atoms from carbon dioxide, or CO2, to form long chains of glucose molecules, or sugar, or C6H12O6. One byproduct of photosynthesis is oxygen, or O2, released to the atmosphere. And this is another way plants and other primary producers can be seen as essential to life as we know it. Plants are sometimes referred to as the lungs of the planet. The process of photosynthesis can be summarized in an equation. 6 CO2, carbon dioxide, plus 6 H2O, water, plus light energy equals C6H12O6, glucose, plus 6 O2, oxygen. Glucose molecules produced through photosynthesis represent a form of high-quality potential energy. This energy can be used by primary producers for their own biological functions, as well as by other organisms that consume the primary producers. Plants use glucose to build stems, roots, fruit, leaves, and other structural elements. Plants also store glucose for future use and to power a process known as cellular respiration. Cellular respiration allows the plant to utilize the potential energy stored in glucose to perform the biochemical processes it needs to grow and survive. Cellular respiration is essentially photosynthesis in reverse. C6H12O6, glucose, plus 6O2, oxygen, equals 6 CO2, carbon dioxide, plus 6 H2O, water, plus energy. Some of the potential energy that is stored in plants as glucose is also available to other organisms that eat either plants or the animals that eat plants. Just as with plants, these animals use respiration to burn the energy stored in the glucose molecules, in the process releasing low-quality heat energy. You can see why energy is described as flowing through ecosystems. Energy enters the system as sunlight and is converted to high-quality potential energy in the form of glucose, utilized by organisms in the environment through respiration and released as energy that dissipates back into space. Chains of energy. Ecologists use the concepts of producers, consumers, and decomposers to describe the flow of energy through an ecosystem. As discussed earlier, autotrophs like plants and algae are producers because they are able to manufacture glucose through the process of photosynthesis. The entire amount of potential energy produced by plants in a given ecosystem is referred to as gross primary production. Because plants use much of this energy for their own biochemical needs, the energy that is left over for other organisms is called net primary production. The organisms that rely on plants for some of that leftover energy are known as consumers. A rabbit that eats grass in an open meadow would be considered a primary consumer, whereas a snake that eats the rabbit would be considered a secondary consumer. A hawk that eats the snake would be considered a tertiary consumer. All of these consumers are known as heterotrophs. Recall that primary producers are referred to as autotrophs, meaning they can produce their own food. Auto equals self, troph equals nourish. In contrast, heterotrophs refers to organisms that rely on other organisms for their food. Hetero equals other, troph equals nourish. While primary consumers are herbivores, plant eaters, secondary and tertiary consumers can be either carnivores, which eat other animals, or omnivores, which eat both plants and other animals. Last but not least are what are known as decomposers. Decomposers break down dead organic material, whether plants or animals, to obtain the energy and nutrients they need. Also known as saprotrophs, sapro equals rotten, troph equals nourish, decomposers include bacteria and fungi like mushrooms, as well as scavenging animals like vultures and hyenas. Decomposers play a critical but often overlooked role in breaking down dead organic material and releasing important nutrients that can be reused by producers for a new round of growth. Energy flows in an ecosystem through food chains. For example, the hawk that ate the snake, that ate the rabbit, that ate the grass. In other words, food chains describe simple, linear feeding relationships among organisms. Ecosystems are characterized by many different food chains that combined make up a food web, which describes the many feeding relationships in a community. See figure 2.5 in your ebook. One important characteristic of food chains and food webs is that primary producers are far more abundant than primary consumers, and primary consumers are more abundant than secondary consumers, and so on. Ecologists use the concept of trophic levels to explain this. Each link in a food chain is considered a trophic level, and as we move from one trophic level to the next, we lose energy because of the second law of thermodynamics. As a result, trophic levels in ecosystems tend to be characterized by a pyramid shape, with large numbers of organisms at lower trophic levels and a few at the top. See figure 2.6 in your ebook. On average, ecologists estimate that only about 10% of the energy consumed at one trophic level is available to the next level. In other words, 10,000 pounds of grass in a meadow might only support 1,000 pounds of rabbits, which could support 100 pounds of snakes, which could support 10 pounds of hawks. As a result, most food chains are typically characterized by only 3 or 4 trophic levels. Matter cycling in ecosystems. The previous section described how energy tends to flow through ecosystems, entering as sunlight and leaving as heat. In contrast, water and chemical elements such as carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus tend to cycle in ecosystems. Scientists who study such cycles, known as biogeochemical cycles, know that the same atom of carbon used by a tree outside your window for photosynthesis may have been exhaled by a human or animal thousands of years ago. This is because of the law of conservation of matter, which holds that matter can neither be created nor destroyed. If you look back at the chemical reactions for photosynthesis and respiration, you'll see that the carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen take different forms, but are always present in the same quantities on both sides of the equation. The principle of conservation of matter was summed up by the late ecologist Barry Commoner as, "Everything must go somewhere. or "There is no away." Credit 1971, page 39. When we burn fossil fuels like oil and coal, which contain mostly carbon, we are moving that carbon from one place, the deep earth, where it had been buried for millions of years, and putting it in another place, in this case, the atmosphere, as carbon dioxide. When we mine phosphate deposits to make fertilizer, and some of that fertilizer runs into streams and rivers, we are moving phosphorus from one place to another, but it does not go away. The rest of this section will review three critical biogeochemical cycles: carbon, phosphorus, and nitrogen. The water cycle will be explained in Chapter 5. The carbon cycle. Carbon is a basic building block of organic compounds required for life. Carbon circulates through the biosphere, atmosphere, and hydrosphere, and is stored in underground deposits in the lithosphere. Figure 2.7 in your ebook is a basic illustration of the carbon cycle, showing carbon flows from one reservoir of carbon to another. Recall that carbon in the atmosphere, in the form of carbon dioxide, is utilized by plants for photosynthesis. Some of that carbon is used to build plant tissue, and some of the plant tissue is eaten by animals and converted into their own tissue. Both plants and animals respire, returning some of that carbon to the atmosphere. As animals and plants die, the carbon in their tissue is deposited in the soil, where some is consumed and respired back to the atmosphere by decomposers. Some of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is also dissolved in the ocean, where it can be utilized by marine algae and plankton before being deposited in sediments at the bottom of the ocean for long periods. Human activities are having a serious impact on the carbon cycle. Over millions of years, carbon stored in deposits of dead plant and animal tissue has been converted through geologic processes to fossil fuels like coal, oil, and natural gas. More on this in Chapter 7. Since the start of the Industrial Revolution, we have dug and pumped massive amounts of these fuels from the ground and burned them, taking carbon that was in the ground for millions of years and adding it to the atmosphere over just a short period of time. Because we are adding carbon to the atmosphere faster than it can be removed, atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide have increased from roughly 270 parts per million a century ago to over 400 parts per million today. Credit Lindsay, 2018A. Because carbon dioxide is a powerful greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, these higher concentrations are a big reason for global climate change. In addition to burning fossil fuels, other human activities like clearing and burning forests and other vegetation are also adding large amounts of carbon to the atmosphere and altering the global carbon cycle. The phosphorus cycle. Phosphorus is an important nutrient for life and is considered a limiting factor in many ecosystems. The major reservoir for this nutrient is phosphate rock or ore. These ores have accumulated over thousands of years and are brought to the Earth's surface through geological uplifting of deep ocean sediment. As these rocks are exposed to rain and other elements, they gradually break down, releasing inorganic phosphate ions. These phosphate ions are carried by water into the soil, where they can either be absorbed by plant roots and utilized as an important nutrient for plant growth, or washed out into the oceans, where, over time, they become a part of deep ocean sediments once again. Organic phosphate in plants can be available to primary consumers that eat the plants, as well as secondary consumers, and so on through ecosystem food webs. As plants and animals die, decomposers break down their tissue and make phosphorus available again for new plant growth. Phosphorus is considered a limiting factor, or limiting nutrient, because most soils contain little phosphate. Because of this, large deposits of phosphorus are mined around the world and incorporated into fertilizers to help promote plant growth. Much of the phosphorus in fertilizer runs off of farm fields and makes its way into streams, rivers, and ultimately the ocean, where it can lead to a serious water pollution problem known as eutrophication. See the case study in section 2.4. The phosphorus fertilizer that gets taken up by crops ends up being eaten by the animals that eat those plants, usually humans, cows, pigs, or chickens. These animals' waste products also contain some of that phosphorus. Remember, there is no away. And this waste can also find its way into bodies of water and add to the eutrophication problem. The nitrogen cycle. Like phosphorus, nitrogen is also a critical nutrient for all forms of life and can act as a limiting factor in plant growth. The largest pool or reservoir of nitrogen on the planet is air. See figure 2.8 in your ebook. With nitrogen making up 78% of the volume of the atmosphere. Despite this abundance, plants cannot make use of atmospheric or non-reactive nitrogen. In nature, nitrogen becomes available to plants through two processes, electrical storms and biological fixation by bacteria. The sheer energy of a lightning bolt is enough to break a non-reactive nitrogen molecule, N2, into two, where N can combine with oxygen to produce nitrogen oxides. These wash out in rain as nitrates and become available to plants for growth. Certain types of soil bacteria are also able to convert non-reactive nitrogen in the air to a usable form through a process known as nitrogen fixation. Some of these bacteria live on the roots of certain plants, known as legumes, for example, beans and peas, and exist in a form of symbiosis, whereby the plants provide what the bacteria need and the bacteria provide for the plant. Symbiosis is a close biological interaction between two organisms. Human modification of the nitrogen cycle occurs because we use industrial processes to remove nitrogen from the atmosphere and turn it into nitrogen fertilizer. This is known as industrial nitrogen fixation and requires tremendous amounts of energy to accomplish. Non-reactive nitrogen is removed from the air and combined with hydrogen, usually derived from natural gas, to make ammonia-based fertilizers. As with phosphorus, nitrogen fertilizers are added to farm fields to promote plant growth. And, as with phosphorus, nitrogen fertilizers run off into bodies of water and contribute to the pollution problem known as eutrophication. The carbon, phosphorus, and nitrogen cycles show that matter is cycled in natural systems. In contrast, energy flows into, through, and out of ecosystems. Energy enters the system as sunlight and powers photosynthesis as the basis for most life on the planet. The energy produced by photosynthesis is released as heat or waste energy, as plants consume their own stored energy, animals consume plants, and other animals eat those animals. Matter in the form of water, carbon, phosphorus, nitrogen, and other nutrients is taken up by plants and enters food webs, where it generally cycles back to be used again. Human interactions in these systems tend to disrupt the cyclical processes and replace them with linear ones. We mine phosphorus and use industrial processes to produce nitrogen, which is added to farm fields to promote plant growth. These nutrients enter other systems, where they can create the pollution problems described in section 2.4. We then mine and produce more fertilizer and repeat the same process. This approach is not sustainable. One of the biggest challenges in moving from our current systems of economic production to more sustainable systems is to try to mimic or copy the cyclical models we find in nature. Section 2.4, Case Study, Eutrophication in the Gulf of Mexico. Recall from section 2.3. that both nitrogen and phosphorus are considered limiting factors or limiting nutrients in most ecosystems. In other words, even if other conditions are favorable for plant growth and other life, the absence or scarcity of nitrogen and phosphorus will limit overall growth. Because this nutrient limitation is true of most farmland, nitrogen and phosphorus are widely applied as fertilizers in commercial farm operations around the world. When some of those fertilizers get washed off of fields and into rivers, streams, lakes, and oceans. It can cause a water pollution problem known as eutrophication. Eutrophication leads to sharp declines in dissolved oxygen levels in bodies of water, and this can kill off fish and other marine life. The result is what ecologists refer to as a dead zone. Defining eutrophication. What is eutrophication, and why would something good, like fertilizer, lead to something bad, like dead zones? The answer lies in the fact that nitrogen and phosphorus are also limiting nutrients in aquatic or water-based ecosystems. When excess nitrogen or phosphorus enters a body of water, like the Gulf of Mexico, it fertilizes and promotes the rapid growth of plant-like phytoplankton, algae and cyanobacteria, commonly referred to as an algae bloom. Under normal conditions, phytoplankton can be a source of food for other marine life. But when eutrophication occurs, the organisms that typically consume phytoplankton can't keep up. This leads to large quantities of phytoplankton eventually dying and sinking to the bottom, where they are decomposed by other bacteria. These bacteria use dissolved oxygen in the water as part of the decomposition process, and this results in sharp declines in oxygen levels. Low oxygen levels can lead to the death and displacement of all kinds of marine life, resulting in dead zones. Examining the problem in the Gulf. Aquatic dead zones can be found in many parts of the world. Environmental scientists estimate that there are over 400 dead zones globally. Credit Diaz and Rosenberg, 2008. In the United States, the Gulf of Mexico dead zone is considered the largest, and this has a lot to do with geography. The Gulf of Mexico receives all the water drained from the Mississippi River, and the Mississippi alone drains over 40% of the surface area of the lower 48 states. The Mississippi River Basin also includes much of the largest agricultural production areas in the country, where large amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizers are applied to fields of corn, soybeans, and other commodity crops. Some of the largest animal feedlots and production areas, beef, chicken, and pork in particular, in the United States, are also located in the Mississippi River Basin, and the waste products from these animals contain large quantities of nitrogen and phosphorus. When people eat crops grown with nitrogen and phosphorus, or eat animals that were fed those crops, they also take in and eventually release most of those nutrients through their waste. Municipal sewage treatment plants strive to remove as much of this nitrogen and phosphorus as possible, but older systems are not very effective at this. Lastly, common fertilizers applied to lawns, gardens, and golf courses also contain nitrogen and phosphorus. All of these sources can add nutrients that run off into nearby bodies of water before being washed down to the sea. Eutrophication is a regular seasonal occurrence in the Gulf of Mexico. Spring rains and snowmelt coincide with large applications of fertilizer at the start of the growing season. By early summer, hypoxic or low oxygen conditions start to appear in the Gulf and typically worsen as the summer goes on. Eventually, seasonal storms, including hurricanes, help mix the water in the Gulf and return oxygen to hypoxic areas. Years that are characterized by heavy rains in the upper Midwest and higher river flows in the Mississippi usually result in larger dead zones. In contrast, the Gulf of Mexico dead zone typically shrinks in years of drought. Scientists have been measuring oxygen levels and hypoxic conditions in the Gulf of Mexico since 1985, and the largest annual dead zone ever recorded was in the summer of 2017. That year, the Gulf dead zone measured close to 23,300 square kilometers, or 9,000 square miles, roughly the size of New Jersey. Credit National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, 2017. Applying our knowledge. We can use the case study of the Gulf of Mexico dead zone to see how some of the terms and concepts introduced earlier in this chapter apply to the study of ecology and environmental science. First, we need to view the dead zone problem at the landscape level, since it involves connections between many different ecosystems on land and in the water. To understand what was causing the dead zone and what to do about it, scientists needed to apply systems thinking, rather than just looking at one piece of the puzzle. The Gulf of Mexico clearly represents an open system, receiving inputs of nitrogen and phosphorus from other systems. Phytoplankton blooms can set off short-term positive feedback loops, as declining oxygen levels drive away organisms that might feed on and control the population of phytoplankton. As oxygen levels drop, marine life moves further away from the optimal range and toward the limits of tolerance, sometimes resulting in reproductive failure, migration, and death, all examples of stress. A tipping point can be reached at which most marine life cannot survive in that area. The dead zone problem is triggered by nitrogen and phosphorus, which are limiting factors introduced to the Gulf ecosystem by human activities. The movement of these nutrients from farms, feedlots, golf courses, lawns, and sewage treatment plants to the Gulf of Mexico is an example of the law of conservation of matter and the cycling of matter. In the words of Commoner, everything is connected to everything else. Everything must go somewhere, and there is no away. Lastly, this case study further illustrates how linear human systems are compared to the kinds of cyclical systems we see in nature. We mine phosphorus from the ground or extract nitrogen from the atmosphere at great cost. We apply these to crops and feed the crops to animals. We eat the animals, and the nitrogen and phosphorus pollution from fertilizer runoff, animal waste, and our own waste makes its way to the Gulf of Mexico, where it triggers an environmental catastrophe. We then mine more phosphorus, produce more nitrogen, and start the process all over again. Even though dead zones of a smaller size can occur naturally under certain conditions, the size, scale, and regularity of the dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico and over 400 other regions of the world can be interpreted as a giant check engine light. Something is wrong with the way we are currently managing our agricultural, water, and energy resources. The specifics of what is wrong, as well as what can be done to correct the situation, will be the focus of later chapters.